It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Tens of thousands of Wisconsin households depend on heating bill assistance to stay warm, but the federal government's low-income home energy assistance program was one of the federal aid programs that was put on hold during the 43-day shutdown.
Here in Wisconsin, our state's home energy assistance program uses a mix of state and federal funds to help low-income households pay for their energy, heating, and cooling bills year-round. The government shutdown interrupted a major funding stream for that program.
To get the latest, we're joined by Diana Moss, Assistant Deputy Secretary at the Wisconsin Department of Administration, which administers the state's home energy assistance program. Diana, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
So the state usually receives these federal dollars this month through the low-income home energy assistance program. Government shutdown interrupted this allocation. What is the latest on these federal funds?
Right. At this time, we still don't have our allocation. However, I want to encourage folks that providers, our home energy assistance providers, are accepting applications. And the good news is that our utility companies are accepting that promise to pay while we await the federal dollars. So as long as folks are applying and they're eligible, we can ensure that they remain connected. And now we're, you know, state law prohibits utility companies from turning off heat from November 1 to April 15th. We're in that moratorium period. And so the good news is their heat can't be turned off. But again, we're accepting applications right now, so that as soon as we receive the federal dollars, we can disperse them as appropriate.
When you look at the numbers coming in, what do you notice about application numbers now?
Yeah, so right now we've got more than 43,000 eligible applications with another 17,000 pending. So those are still awaiting review. We notice that at this point in the program year, you know, that could be because of the federal shutdown. Maybe folks were thinking, oh, there's not money, so why would I apply? Mm. Or it could be because maybe we've had a seasonably warm, start to the heating season. But, you know, you just reported we're heading into some winter weather here. So, again, a lot of factors could go into it, but our applications at this point in the year seem to be down. We still anticipate the same need over the program year. Last year, we served 186,000 households. So again, would encourage folks to apply now.
So how much funding does Wisconsin usually receive from the federal government for the energy aid program? What is that mix between state and federal funding?
So the program, our Wisconsin Home Energy Assistance Program, again, is a mix of state federal funding. It includes the LIHEAP dollars that you're talking about from the federal government. It includes crisis assistance and some public benefits funds. And that program overall then provides some direct to utility company payments on behalf of residents. It can help with furnace assistance, so repair, replacement, and then crisis assistance. And all of that, you know, last year we disbursed $136 million through that program, but $110 million is that federal LIHEAP funding.
What happens if that funding is delayed further? Do you have a plan?
Right. So we anticipate the funding's coming. We know it's delayed. We anticipate, you know, several weeks more of delay. The good news is that we have, we're in that moratorium, so the heat can't be turned off. And, you know, we're confident that the feds are working on it right now. And as soon as they have their calculations done and can get us the money, we'll be ready to disperse as soon as we can.
Diana, can you explain who is eligible to apply for heating assistance?
Right. So it's based on income, and it's typically 60% of the median. However, if folks apply right now and they say they're deemed ineligible, we would encourage them to apply again, because if their life circumstances change, maybe someone loses a job in the family, or maybe they have a child, you know, we would recalculate that eligibility. And again, our home energy assistance program in Wisconsin also covers crisis assistance. And so if they're in a true crisis, you know, their furnace goes out, encourage them to apply because, you know, we've got dollars to help address that crisis.
Diana, thank you so much for the update.
Yeah, happy to provide it. Again, encourage folks to apply at wisenergy.wi.gov. And, you know, we're here to help.
That is Diana Moss, Assistant Deputy Secretary at the Wisconsin Department of Administration, which runs the Wisconsin Home Energy Assistance Program, helping households that struggle to pay their energy bills. Now to a statewide nonprofit that is also working on this issue. Energy Services Incorporated serves over 100,000 households annually. Tim Brewer is Executive Director. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What is demand like now for energy assistance in Wisconsin? What do you notice about households experiencing energy insecurity?
One of the things that's very clear is that, you know, heat, which is a basic necessity, has become an unaffordable luxury for literally tens of thousands of Wisconsinites. Sadly, those who are the most vulnerable, the elderly, the disabled, young families, who are working where they have, in most cases, multiple jobs, their incomes just simply haven't kept pace. So to say that there is a panic throughout the state from this population is not really given the due diligence that it really deserves, in that, fortunately, in Wisconsin, we have an incredibly aggressive governor, and the Secretary of Department Administration has been in the forefront to provide our organization with the tools and resources, along with the charitable dollars for the Keep Wisconsin Warm Fund or Heat of Our Heroes, to provide a temporary bridge for those the most serious, for them who are coming forward. Heat, which is a basic necessity, has become an unaffordable luxury, and we're also having to deal with pride issues in that they offer the biggest artificial barriers that are prohibiting people to apply. But as the previous speaker mentioned, also there's a lot of confusion out there with the people not knowing or not believing that the funds are going to be there, or we are seeing folks who are literally walking away from the program because they believe that they've received a much needed survival assistance in the past. And now there's others who are also in much greater need.
Tim, Tim, I want to just jump in here and ask you to explain the working relationship like between energy services, between utility companies, the state, and what your organization is able to do to bridge these gaps with utility bills.
You know, again, this administration has made it very clear that no Wisconsinite will face the bitter cold alone. They have mobilized as much of the public dollars as possible that are being matched by private contributions, and in particularly from Wisconsinites throughout every zip code in the state who contribute to the Keep Wisconsin Warm Coal Fund, or those who are committed to veterans with the Heat and Housing for Heroes. We're in the position now as a principal emergency and energy assistance organization. We're the clearinghouse in many respects for people who are applying for the first time, and we are able to offer an online application for assistance.
Tim, I think we just Tim, are you still there? Can you hear us? I think we just lost Tim Brewer with Energy Services Incorporated. They're a statewide nonprofit that is working on this issue with families who are struggling to pay their energy bills. Tim is Executive Director of Energy Services Incorporated. And you can join in with your experience about energy bills, how you've paid them, what you've noticed with your bill from month to month, or if you have you know, applied for this assistance. You can email and share your story, Wisconsin Today at WPR.org. That's Wisconsin Today at WPR.org as we learn about how utility companies, the state, and nonprofits are working together on this issue of energy assistance. And during the government shutdown, what that's been like to wait for energy assistance. We had Diana Moss, who is Assistant Deputy Secretary at the Wisconsin Department of Administration, which runs the Wisconsin Home Energy Assistance Program.
And even if you haven't relied on programs like LIHEAP, the Low-Income Heating and Energy Assistance Program, what are you seeing when it comes to your energy bills these days? Whatever form of power you rely on, electricity, natural gas, if you rely on propane to heat through the winter, love to hear what you're seeing with costs in your neck of the woods, whether they're holding steady or going up. Let us know. You can email Wisconsin Today at WPR.org. That's Wisconsin Today at WPR.org. Or give us a call at 888-642-0232.
Okay, we're going now back to Tim Brewer. Reestablish that line. Tim, what can households do while waiting for assistance to come through?
Well, you know, clearly the impact of those dollars being delayed from Washington has created a collision course. But for the support, as I mentioned earlier, the governor, Secretary Blumenfeld from DOA, and the tremendous humanitarian perspective and response from our utilities, you know, we've been able to work hand in hand with those individuals who call us most often right now in crisis situations, and we're able to deploy for a limited period of time our charitable arm, which is the Keep Wisconsin Warm Cool Fund, or the Heat and Housing for Heroes. And we have also energy funds through, for example, Alliant Energy. They simply need to call us. We have the ability to take their application online. It's pretty simplistic. We're able to help those people who are reluctant or who are of the mindset that they have received help in the past, but now they believe that others are more deserving.
And Tim, we have to leave it there. Tim Brewer is Executive Director of Energy Services Incorporated. It's a nonprofit providing energy assistance around the state.
Coming up in Wisconsin Today, a boom in data center construction around Wisconsin. The Milwaukee School of Engineering says students are flooding into programs to fill the construction management workforce with jobs waiting on the other side.
Everyone gets a job because there is so much work to be done.
That conversation is next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Data center construction projects are in the works all over Wisconsin. Currently, the state is home to nearly 50 centers. That's according to the data center map.
A new report by JP Morgan Chase says more than $5 trillion is set to be spent on building out global data centers and AI infrastructure and the related power supplies over the next 5 years.
A portion of those investment dollars are flowing into projects here in the state. We're checking in now with a union group that's lining up labor to help construct these data centers around the Midwest.
Pat Nilsson is Executive Secretary Treasurer of the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters, which represents nearly 27,000 union members from 6 states, including Wisconsin. Pat, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
How big is data center construction now to the union's mix of industry jobs for carpenters in the Midwest and here in Wisconsin? What is that piece of pie?
I don't have the exact number, but it is growing. I know Wisconsin, we've done worked on one data center, the Microsoft data center in Racine. We do have some very large projects in the Cedar Rapids, Iowa area, and in the Omaha, Nebraska area, there's been ongoing data centers for 10, 15 years. And then there's some upcoming in Minnesota. It's growing.
Are data center jobs more lucrative, or are they better than other potential jobs for carpenters?
I don't know if they're more lucrative. I mean, they do provide an opportunity for members to work. And like I said, the data centers that have been ongoing in the Nebraska and Council Bluffs, Iowa area have been going on for several years. So it's a good opportunity for members to have long-term work.
Right, because the longer the time you spend on a job site, you know, the more stability, the more paychecks. What about the duration of these jobs on site? How do they compare to other projects?
I think with the scope and size of them and the investment that some of these companies are putting in, like they'll build one data center and then that one is getting complete and then they'll pop up two or three more in the same area. I guess I forgot to mention Des Moines, Iowa has got quite a few data centers and they're in the same situation. They just one comes up after another.
So carpenters can go from one site right on to the next without much lag time between jobs.
Yes.
You've called data centers essential for apprenticeships. Why is that?
It's a great opportunity for us to recruit new members. Data centers, they're so big and they need such a workforce that it gives us the opportunity to go out and recruit, and the apprentices go through our apprenticeship program, but also get the on-the-job hours that they need working on the data centers because they are such a, could potentially be a long-term project.
Your organization is supporting the proposed data center plans in DeForest here in Wisconsin, and you say the project would be a $12 billion investment, support thousands of trade jobs over a decade. Are there enough people working in the trades now to meet that need?
I don't think so. I think that, it gives us the opportunity to bring in that workforce. We have met the demands of the other data centers that have been going on within our regional council through different creative ways in recruiting. We do recruitment through web pages, job fairs. And recently in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, we did a kind of a career job fair in partnership with our contractors. And it's kind of similar to what the NFL does with their combine. We bring in contractors that are hiring and we bring in potential workers, people that are interested in going to work on the data centers, and they have an opportunity to show the employers what they can do with different skills, that, you know, different skill stations that we put up. And we had, several people hired right into the apprenticeship program the day we did that event.
What are the skills that carpenters need to put up these data centers?
Biggest skill that any carpenter needs is attitude. You know, you have the right attitude to go to work every day, be on time. That's the biggest thing. The skills can be taught through our training programs, but anything from concrete, metal studs and drywall, whatever is needed on the project.
And your union, it covers six states in the Midwest. Are you seeing similar interest and demand in data center projects for other states?
Yes, especially Cedar Rapids is the one that's kind of growing the fastest. They've got a few data centers there. I think one of them is a 15 square mile project, if I'm not mistaken. There's potential work there for quite some time.
Some people in the communities where these proposed data centers would be built, they're resistant to the projects. Is that having an effect on union involvement in the projects, or aren't you seeing that yet?
We haven't seen that. I mean, we just support them because they provide a good job, good wages and benefits. And, you know, I've seen some statistics and reports that, you know, we need a data center a week in this country to keep up the pace with what AI and everything else is coming. And I don't see, I'm not a professional or an expert in that, but I just don't see with all the use of the technology that we have that data centers are going to go away. And if they're going to build them, we want to be the people that are building them.
You've been a carpenter for over three decades. Have you seen this type of, upscale in an industry before? Certainly data centers weren't here in the 80s. Have you seen this type of surge before?
I haven't, not in, where I've worked.
Yeah. What is your difficult challenge now, to keep pace with the data center needs? What do you grapple with?
It's just the worker issue, getting enough workers to do the projects. And so far, we've been able to manage that very well.
Pat, thank you so much for joining us with this update.
All right. Well, thank you.
Pat Nilsen is a carpenter and executive secretary treasurer of the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. Now we turn to education and how a college looks to meet the engineering needs for data center construction. That's a sector that is ballooning. Willie Ganwa is a professor and program director for the Department of Civil and Architectural Engineering and Construction Management at the Milwaukee School of Engineering. Willie, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Kate.
Data center projects there underway across the state. They're happening around the country. How would you describe this construction boom?
You're right. It is a boom. Everything else in the construction industry is slowing down. Residential apartment buildings are slowing down. A lot of the office buildings are rising default rates, which are slowing things down. The only thing that is booming, that is really going on right now, is these data centers.
Have you seen a construction boom like this before?
So intense, I never have. When I think of data centers, I think of large developments, big campuses, and I stretch way back to the booms of building shopping malls, which was, 1970s or 1980s, when like in the Milwaukee area, there was North Ridge and South Ridge and Mayfair Mall built, where you basically took a huge hunk of land and put up big buildings and big parking lots. So it's been a long time since we've seen that. And of course, during war times, like World War II, of course, there was such construction, but that was almost ancient history.
What is the role of civil engineers, of construction management engineers for these data center projects? What do they have their hands on?
So in our department, we have civil engineers, architectural engineers, and construction managers, and they're all involved in these data centers. So the architectural engineers are dealing with the structures of the buildings themselves, the heating, ventilation, air conditioning, which are huge, huge demands. When we talk about energy usage for these data centers, so much of the energy and the water uses for cooling the machinery down. So there's tremendous demands on that. In just the site development, you can't put a building on a site without major regrading of the land and dealing with the topography, dealing with the natural features and managing all of that. And that's in the civil engineering. And the construction managers, the people managing the whole project, we have a program in construction management, and there are many dozens of construction managers on every single one of these data projects. The construction managers are there to, one might focus on just concrete, and another one might focus just on the ductwork or something like that. So it takes a huge team, dozens of construction managers. And of course, there's the trades that are involved too, but on the engineering and construction management end.
They all have their specialties. Yeah.
Yeah.
Willie, I think of these data centers as pretty basic warehouses filled with servers without architectural interest. And I'm wondering, could there be more thoughtful or novel designs of these new data centers to situate them in the landscape of communities?
Well, think about the EPIC campus in Verona.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Does that have visual interest?
Yes.
You can do that. You can create visual interest. If you've gone along highways, and how many standard bridges have you ever driven under? Thousands and thousands of standard bridges. And then every once in a while, you drive underneath a bridge with architectural interest because someone's put the time and thought and money to create architectural interest in a signature bridge for a community, something like that.
Your background is in environmental engineering. What happens to the land that's surrounding these data centers once construction begins? Because from what I understand, these plots have to be very flat and even.
Yes, they have to be very flat and even. So Wisconsin, it's at least in southeast Wisconsin, is full of all this glacial geology, which has wetlands all over the place. Well, when you're putting up a big data center, all these wetlands have to be basically obliterated. Now, Wisconsin has laws in place that if you're obliterating a wetland, that you're given opportunities to create it somewhere else in that same watershed or maybe elsewhere in the state. So you can mitigate the impacts of what you're doing, but you can't prevent it. And you've got all this rooftop that you're going to, the water's going to run off that rooftop, and it's going to want to run into those streams and just run down. It's going to increase flooding until you start mitigating it. So even if you hold the water back, it's not going to infiltrate. So then you have to try to figure out how to infiltrate it. Now, these are requirements with any development in Wisconsin, that you have to mitigate the impacts of reduced infiltration, increased runoff, water quality impacts. And that's where a lot of civil engineering work comes in, where you're trying to mitigate those impacts. But when I say mitigate, you're not going to prevent them. You're not going to turn the clock back. It's going to make, perhaps it'll have some environmental impacts, but what you're trying to do is to mitigate the worst impacts of those.
What would be like specific sustainability requirements on tech companies that would be seeking to build data centers in Wisconsin? Should there be more sustainability requirements?
Well, the big sustainability issues, two big sustainability issues on data centers are energy use and water use, because there's a lot of water use, a lot of energy use. And if you're just using the water and evaporating it, then you're going to use tons and tons of water. Now, if you're near Lake Michigan, you might have an opportunity to utilize the Lake Michigan water supply. But if you're outside of Lake Michigan, you're pumping groundwater. And we have limited groundwater supplies. And certain areas, when you pump groundwater, you're just mining it. In kind of human timeframes, you're never going to get that water back. And there are areas of the country where there's much more severe groundwater issues than in Wisconsin. Wisconsin's blessed with a lot of water, but we have areas of Wisconsin that are being impacted. The Central Sand Plains is impacted by groundwater lowering because of irrigation practices. If any data centers are located in central Wisconsin, there's a huge amount of water in the sand, near surface sand aquifers. But you start using that water and you start seeing less water in rivers like the Little Plover River. And so we have water impacts, but then energy impacts are huge. We talk about energy usage associated with buildings being somewhere in the order of like 35% of the United States energy usage. But data centers are climbing from 3% to 5% to 10% to 12%. If you think about it, data centers might use up like one third of the energy associated with buildings in the whole United States. So that's huge. And where does that energy come from? There's so many environmental impacts associated with electricity production, electricity transmission. Whether you use sustainable production or not, you still have a lot of energy to supply. And where does that come from? Older power plants are left online that otherwise would have been retired. What happens to people's electricity bill when you have to buy electricity at higher costs? There's just a huge number of potential impacts.
All the ripple effects. I want to go back to a data center construction site here. And I'm wondering, are firms able to repurpose like defunct manufacturing plants or shuttered warehouses to house new data centers? Or do these centers need to be built from the ground up with new materials?
Certainly, there are opportunities to build data centers on defunct pieces of land, brownfields. I believe there's a proposal to put a data center at the old GM plant in Janesville. Certainly, that's many, many acres of land that is being not utilized at all. Now, there are people who are not for that. There are people who are for that. So certainly, an example of one large brownfield site that could be repurposed for a data center.
Willie, you're training the next generation of construction engineers, construction managers. What demand are you seeing for these roles from companies in Wisconsin and around the country?
We just had a career fair here, just for our Department of Civil Engineers, Architectural Engineers, Construction Managers. And there were so many companies here where I'd ask them, so what are you working on? They're saying they're working on data centers and they're hiring people. We have here at MSOE in our departments, we have 100% hiring of our graduates. The only people who don't get jobs are people who don't want jobs because they want to go do something else. But basically it's 98% employment. Everyone gets a job because there is so much work to be done.
And you also have seen the largest class size for your department. Is this data center boom drawing students and taking them away from other engineering disciplines?
Oh, that's certainly. We just got through with advising where students have to choose their classes for the next year. And that really is the trigger for students who want to consider a different program to change. And in the last couple of weeks, I think I've talked to at least 10 students from different departments. Now, this is just within MSOE, transferring from their program to with interest transferring from to civil engineering. I know the construction management program director has also talked to about 10 different students. And these students, I've talked to students from actuarial science, from construction, or from computer science, actuarial science, from mechanical engineering, just various fields where they're saying, maybe things will be better if I go into the construction field.
Willie, thank you for this update. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, Kate.
Willie Ganwa is a professor and program director for the Department of Civil and Architectural Engineering and Construction Management at the Milwaukee School of Engineering. We've been talking about the labor demands for future data center construction projects and how to meet them. Earlier, we heard from Pat Nilsson, a carpenter for 32 years, who is on the executive board of the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters.
Coming up, meet the person who runs the Milwaukee Bucks social media channels, bringing the fan base even closer to the team through pictures and video.
It's a lot of fun to be able to attend sports games for work and cover those online for fans to enjoy.
What it's like to work with superstar athletes, that's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
The Milwaukee Bucks started their 2025-2026 season late last month after an offseason with some significant roster changes around star Giannis Antetokounmpo.
Fans are getting to know some new faces and new roles, and much of that acclimation process comes through the Bucks' social media channels, where pictures and videos bring the fan base even closer to the team.
The person behind the Bucks' online platforms is Mount Horeb native Jesse Clark. Clark is a UW-Madison alum who was promoted to social media director before the start of the season.
He's the one who's holding the phones for videos, hitting send on Instagram posts, and reading the flow of positive and negative comments that come through.
To find out what it's like to work with superstar athletes, we called up Jesse Clark. Jesse, welcome to the program.
Appreciate you having me on.
Okay, dish please. What is it like to run social media for a pro sports team like the Bucks?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, a lot of responsibility, too. I mean, any message that we send out can potentially reach our 13 million followers across all of our primary social platforms. So there's a lot of responsibility that comes with it. But it's a lot of fun to be able to attend sports games for work and cover those online for fans to enjoy. You never know what to expect on a given game night, which is really fun and exciting, but also is a challenge because you have to make sure you're able to pivot depending on how the game goes. It's been a lot of fun in my career to be able to do this, and I'm really fortunate to be able to do what I do. It's a lot of fun.
You're working in a digital orbit, so that's 24/7. Do you feel like you can ever step away?
It's a great question. There is a 24/7 aspect to this job, certainly. I mean, there are times when Bucks-related news breaks that I have to be available to handle, or someone on the social team can handle. And I'm very fortunate to have a social team at the Milwaukee Bucks. And so if one person isn't available, hopefully someone else can step in. So being able to have that staffing is really beneficial to kind of provide that flexibility when needed. And so that's been really great. We've been able to build the social team here and expand it recently at the Bucks. So there is an aspect where we do always have to be online. Certainly we want to be cognizant of trends and capitalize on those and be topical in that way. But we also have a social team to be able to balance life and what that brings from a personal standpoint as well.
And so you aren't just the sole anonymous voice behind all of these posts, that you have multiple people sending them out.
Correct. Yes, I manage a social team that includes two full-time coordinators and then also two social media interns. So between the five of us, it could be any one of us posting on any one of those platforms. And so we're able to kind of rotate and provide some flexibility that way. And so we all play a part in it, and I couldn't do it without them.
You went to UW-Madison. You were a Bucks fan long before you were in this role. What does it mean to go from following this team for fun to doing it professionally from behind the scenes and making really strategic decisions about their social?
Yeah, it's a really fun full circle moment for me. I've been a Bucks fan since I was 5 years old, and I remember going to my first Bucks games at the Bradley Center, rooting for the team. Unfortunately, the team didn't win a lot of games during that time, but my fandom was really strong from the start. And so now, you know, if I would have told 5-year-old self what I'm doing now for a career, I think that kid would be really excited and proud. It means a lot to me to be able to be to make such important decisions and be in charge of sending out these messages and this content to our fan base for this team in particular, because, you know, this team means a lot to the state. It means a lot to me. It means a lot to the city of Milwaukee. So it's not lost on me, the responsibility that I have. And, you know, hopefully fans appreciate, you know, the content that we do post and the effort we put behind it on social, because it's a lot of fun and it's a lot of responsibility. And it feels good to be able to have that responsibility professionally, you know, with this organization.
You've done this type of work for the Kansas City Royals. You've done this type of work for the Houston Texans. I wonder now, though, is it harder this way when you have an emotional connection to the Bucks? You have this history for you to separate yourself from that, you know, when you are already so tied to the team?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, while it is especially meaningful to me, I think just the professional mode kicks in, you know, especially during a game setting. You know, we're so reactionary to what's happening on the court. There isn't really time for anything else. And so we're just so locked in from a task standpoint that, you know, we just handle whatever comes our way. And I'm not really thinking about my, you know, personal fandom. You know, certainly I think that just helps my general excitement on a day-to-day basis. But I don't feel like it ever kind of, you know, interferes with the work process, since we're in such like a rapidly changing environment and landscape in this role that we don't really have time to think about anything else.
You also are trying to maintain a brand and a voice for the team. What is that balance between being corporate and professional and proper versus, you know, hip and trendy and cutting edge?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's definitely a balance. As a brand, certainly we have a lot of different objectives and different departments have different needs that they need to service on social. And so we need to make sure we're effectively communicating those, whether that's a PR message or community initiative or something that's sponsored through partnerships. And so we want to make sure that we're servicing those needs, but also we want to have fun online too. And we want to be keeping up with the trends. We want to be playful and concise and interact with fans and be engaging. You know, this account serves a lot of different purposes, and certainly we want to be informative and be valuable to partners and increase ticket revenue. We also want to be engaging to fans and increase their fan affinity. Maybe they are a fan and now we can make them a core fan, or maybe they weren't a fan at all, but now they are because they saw our content or a story that we posted that they learned more about a player's background, things like that. It's so hard to stop the thumb from scrolling these days. And so we want to make sure that we're creating content that allows them to do that and engage and share. And when I arrived, we didn't really have a style guide on social that kind of outlines our brand, our voice, and our process. And so that was one of the first things that I worked on, to put that pen to paper. not only does that help when we hire a new social person to kind of guide them in how we approach, but it's also helpful for the organization to see our process and our flow and how we communicate online, how it reflects kind of the values of Wisconsin and Milwaukee and the history of this team, but also witty and playful and edgy when appropriate, because we want to speak concisely and appropriately, but also try to balance all the different needs, both from a social standpoint, but then also how other departments, their messages that need to come across as well.
I want to key in on the word appropriately because, you know, these fans can also be such a thorn in your side. How do you handle the negative comments you get from fans or the trolls on social media?
So I always say that I'd rather have passionate fans in our comments, either positive or negative, mm-hmm. than apathetic ones. And so certainly we get a lot of both. And now we can't control what happens on the court. And sometimes the results are positive and sometimes they're not so positive. And fans are very vocal and eager to share their thoughts because social is their easiest access and touch point to do so with the Bucks. And I think earlier in my career, when there was a lot of negativity, it wore on me because it is our job to see it and read it all the time. And when there's a lot, you know, it can be easy to take it personally or have it weigh on you. But I feel like I've gotten better at that as my career has progressed. And I'd rather them be passionate and vocal than not at all. And so, you know, when those kind of feelings arise and mount, you know, I just remain hopeful that things will change and get better. And we don't really monitor or I should say filter out those comments unless they are like overly violent or sexual bots that we sometimes get online. We're not filtering out those conversations unless they kind of fall into that category. And we won't really respond to those, but we do want to be mindful of the one-on-one interactions that we can provide fans online. If they have a question that we can answer or a surprise and delight moment or responding to some positivity, because I do kind of look at those interactions as a digital autograph of sorts. And it is cool when fans receive, you know, a response, a reply from the official team account. It's not a huge lift on our end, but can be really impactful on theirs. So we do want to be active in the comments and hear what they're saying, respond back to what they're saying, because as a social account, we need to be mindful of the conversations that our fans are having and how can we participate that.
Yeah, you feel like you're singled out, one of a kind. We're talking with Milwaukee Bucks social media director Jesse Clark about what it's like being the person behind a pro sports team's online accounts and that strategy role. Jesse, I want to hone in here on what you said about bots and AI. How have you seen the job of a social media strategist change over your decade working in pro sports?
Yeah, I think the biggest change that I've seen is social media is never getting smaller, right? There are new platforms coming out. Platforms are having different changes to the algorithms, what kind of content they prioritize. And so it is a challenge to be mindful of that, and you need to adapt as that changes, because you ultimately want your content to be best served to your audience. And so as there have been more platforms that have evolved, like when I started, there wasn't TikTok, there wasn't Blue Sky, there wasn't Threads. You need to have a social staff to accommodate that. When I first started, it was just one or two people running social. Now our team is up to 5 full-time and part-timers. Mm. And so I feel like as social has evolved, the staffing needs have had to evolve with it, because you need to be able to, one, you know, appropriately create content for different platforms because they are so different. We're not going to speak the same way to our fans on Facebook like we do TikTok, and that content is also going to be quite different. And so you can't just have one person effectively do that on all channels in this day and age. And so being able to have a fuller staff to accommodate that and tailor your content to the platform has been really, really beneficial. I'm thankful that the Bucks organization has invested in social to be able to increase our staff size to be able to do that.
How does working with Giannis compare to some of the stars you worked with at the Kansas City Royals or the Houston Texans?
Yeah, I've been really fortunate to work with a lot of great athletes, athletes who understand social content and want to participate in it. And so that's been really great. Obviously, every locker room is different. You know, and certain players may prefer to be more content forward on social than others, and that's totally okay. And so it's our job to, you know, work with players who want to work with us and tailor their interests to how we can you know, communicate on social and help elevate their brand as well. And so a lot of athletes that I've worked with, depending on what team it's been, have been really a pleasure to work with. And we were able to create some really great content together, not only for our channel, but for theirs and share in that content. And so that's been really great. I mean, Giannis is obviously an amazing athlete, but he's an amazing person as well. And so very, very fortunate that he is in Milwaukee and we get to work together and also, you know, cover his amazing talent on the court every night.
Well, he did say, you know, as reported on by ESPN last month, that, you know, he's staying off social and focused on his craft. I mean, how does that affect the social media director for the team when his star isn't actively scrolling or perhaps engaging?
Yeah, players who are less social inclined during the season and want to lock in, that is not unique to me or my job. And so, you know, we cover him to the best of our ability with what he's doing on the court, which is extremely valuable. And then we just interact with players and engage with them depending on when they're active and when they're not active. That's totally okay. And we just adapt accordingly.
Hmm. Have you noticed regional differences between fans down in Houston and Kansas City compared to Milwaukee?
In terms of overall sentiment, I don't think so. I think most of that has just been either positive or negative, depending on how the team is performing on the court. And there are obviously ebbs and flows that happen with that over the course of the season, no matter what sport that you're playing. Sometimes we'll tailor our messaging depending on different interests. And certainly, you know, there are differences in interests in Houston, for example, whether it's, you know, pop culture or food, or things like that in Texas that may not apply as directly to Kansas City or Milwaukee. And so we want to make sure we're tapping into kind of the interests of the state and the city and the team as it pertains to social and content series. But in terms of fan sentiment, there are some similarities in just how fans respond depending how the team is performing.
Okay, so this is the point where we have to pull out that crystal ball. What are your expectations for the season after some, you know, kind of big changes in the off season?
Yeah, I try not to have expectations, really. I'm just always hopeful. You know, one of the best parts of this job is not knowing what's going to happen in a given season or on a given game night. And so being able to react to that in real time is a lot of fun and also a bit challenging. Fortunately, we have the best player in basketball on our team, and that provides a lot of excitement on a nightly basis. And we'll always be competitive with Giannis on our roster. And so it's just really fun and challenging to adapt on a game-to-game basis and being able to pivot with our messaging depending on how each individual game goes. And so there's a lot of excitement in that. And so every season is a new season. You never know how it's going to go. And so it's fun to kind of ride that ride and just see how each game goes and capitalize on that to the best of your ability. And hopefully that results, you know, in a successful season and a deep playoff run. You know, I've been very fortunate to, you know, work for an organization that has, you know, won a title recently and brought a championship to Milwaukee. And that's the goal every season. That is our standard. And so I look forward to seeing how this season plays out and hopefully going from there.
Jesse, thank you for joining us.
Of course. It was a pleasure to chat.
That is Mount Horeb native Jesse Clark, the social media director for the Milwaukee Bucks. And Jesse was with us to share what it's like to be the anonymous voice behind a pro sports team's social media channels. I was reading in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend that more and more people are looking for ways to take the pressure off Thanksgiving meal prep, and mail order Thanksgiving is going strong, from a turkey prepared in Texas and arriving in a special box to the gourmet regional side dishes you see or a pie that completes the feast. It is becoming easier than ever to get Thanksgiving delivered.
And we want to know, do you outsource Thanksgiving meal prep, the whole thing or parts of the meal? Or do you do the whole meal yourself or maybe enlist help in the kitchen or some potluck style? And with grocery prices and inflation, what are some of your cost-saving tips for this big meal?
Tell us about your Thanksgiving Day meal strategy as we inch closer to the day. We would love to share your message on the air. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch. That number is 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Royce Podeswa, and Lauren Cox.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.